This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Scientists have found a new word to describe the potential impact of Hurricane Sandy on the East Coast. They're calling it Frankenstorm.
Here, the main concern is flooding. This area is expected to bear the brunt of the storm surge from Hurricane Sandy, and that surge is expected to top 11 feet or nearly 4 meters, which will put a lot of this area underwater.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, the world's emergency room. At least that's what it feels like lately, as we begin to taste the high-carbon future here on planet Earth. The North Americans are bragging about pumping out more oil from dirtier sources, even as drought kills off the crops, and now a humongous record hurricane spins up on the East Coast. We'll talk with Green Radio reporter Daphne Wisham just as the storm hit the North American capital, Washington, D.C. How is the brand new climate spiking these storms like steroids? I'll tell you what top scientists are saying. At the other end of the world, following fires and floods of their own, the Australians are straining to break their own dismal carbon record. My head hurts trying to understand why such nice people want to double their coal exports. Australia is already the biggest coal exporter in the world, keeping black smokestacks in Japan, Taiwan, China, and now India, pouring out more and more carbon dioxide into the overloaded atmosphere. We'll get the goods from down under from Greenpeace Pacific Atmosphere and Energy campaigner Georgina Woods. You'll get to breathe that pollution, you know, and we all get hit with the climate change. I'll wrap up with another story with warning sirens all over it. Canada is already building its own Yucca North, a porous hole where they plan to dump nuclear waste. The best they can do is the worst they can do. The supposed deep geological deposit is just a very shallow hole in limestone caves right beside the Great Lakes. It's up water from millions of people in Chicago, Cleveland, Buffalo, Toronto, and Montreal. Brennane Woods of Northwatch tells us how the aging Bruce Nuclear Plant, the largest running nuclear complex on the planet, and this new storage facility threatens the whole world. I'm Alex Smith. Take a deep breath. We're all heading into a state of ecological shock.
Radio EcoShock.
Let's start with that story covered by every network and the part that they leave out. Global climate disruption makes deadly and costly storms like Hurricane Sandy much more violent. More than two decades ago, scientists told us this would happen, and now it's here. How does it work? Well, first you need to know we've created far more heat on this planet than we feel here on land. The world's great oceans are absorbing more than half the heat held in by those greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. The Gulf Stream, that great ocean current running off North America's east coast until it warms Britain and Northern Europe, it is heating up. According to the UK Met Office, the government body measuring such things, there is a huge area off the mid-Atlantic coast that is 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit or 1.3 degrees hotter than average. That doesn't sound impressive. But that much heat over a giant expanse of ocean is tremendous. But it gets worse. The Gulf Stream itself is currently 5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. Hurricane Sandy cruised up this Gulf Stream, gathering up both energy and extra water moisture in her half-continent-sized clouds. As meteorologist and former storm chaser Jeff Master tells us, the Atlantic was unusually warm right to the end of October, making Sandy stronger and wetter. Did the record amount of open ocean in the Arctic this summer help the Atlantic stay warmer longer? Scientists aren't sure yet. Jennifer Francis of Rutgers, a recent guest on Radio EcoShock, says the blocking weather in the last 2 weeks is consistent with what her team observed from the melting of sea ice in the Arctic. Kevin Trenberth of the National Center for Atmospheric Research agrees the Atlantic currents are 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer in the Gulf Stream than normal, and he attributes 1 degree of that directly to global warming. But he doesn't believe the Arctic melt this summer and fall contributed to it. The jury is still out on that, but the vast majority of scientists agree mega storms like Sandy are more likely to become the new normal due to climate disruption by human-induced emissions of greenhouse gases. Of course, there are skeptics, some of them well paid by the fossil fuel lobby. For example, Patrick J. Michaels of the Cato Institute, who we know has received lots of money from the Koch brothers and others in the powerful oil and coal lobby. He says a storm like Sandy could have happened on a cooling planet as well. He writes Andy Revkin of the New York Times, quote, "I predict confidently that we will survive Sandy, which should not be a tropical cyclone at landfall," end quote. Another ploy used by the climate deniers is to find papers showing there were big storms hundreds of thousands or millions of years ago. In many of those cases, carbon dioxide was high then, too, and there was a hothouse world. And anyway, so what? We're dealing with now, and humans have ramped up the odds of getting a lot of big storms in a short period of time. Meanwhile, on the ground, what was it like? On Monday night, as the big storm landed in Washington, D.C., I spoke with Daphne Wisham. As the cell phone tower swayed, she called for calm. The mainstream media is delivering news while keeping up the great American silence about the role of climate disruption in this unprecedented storm. That's what we're going to talk about with Daphne Wisham, the host of the long-running green radio show Earthbeat and now a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. I reached Daphne in her home in D.C. just as Hurricane Sandy was washing ashore on Monday. Daphne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, and I hope the line remains good. During the storm, we've got about 70-mile-per-hour winds outside right now.
Well, yeah, before we get to that storm, what is happening in Washington?
Well, I'm looking out, and the trees are blowing pretty violently. There's been just constant rainfall since last night. We've had record rainfall here in the nation's capital. The government is shut down. The metro or the underground subway has been shut down. They're asking only emergency personnel to be out on the streets. So we still have power, but we're waiting for power to go off any time.
And you've been busy writing about the aspect of climate change for places like the Huffington Post and Fire Dog Lake. What are you telling folks?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that I was writing about in my column today is basically the title is on not scaring ourselves to death, moving beyond the adrenaline rush of Frankenstorm to real energy independence. And my point is that, you know, if you turn on your television set, it's almost like we go through the same exercise with each one of these major hurricanes. We almost get an adrenaline high out of watching, you know, the waters rising and the weathercasters going out into thigh deep water and standing at the ocean's edge, buffeted by the high winds. And, you know, we sort of get caught up in the drama and almost expect it. And yet, you know, it's sort of ironic that this is all happening right around Halloween when people like to scare themselves to death. And what I'm suggesting is that by sort of getting caught up in the adrenaline rush, we're really fooling ourselves again and again, just as children do every Halloween. And we're not acting like the adults we need to act like, which is basically to understand over and over again when we keep getting buffeted by stronger and stronger storms, there is something very serious happening that we need to pay attention to. And that, of course, as you know, is that we're dealing with a climate crisis of enormous proportions. And there is absolutely no coincidence in the fact that this storm is as great as it is, given that the Arctic is melting, the oceans are warming, there's more energy in the atmosphere. And so, of course, we are going to be seeing an increase in the intensity of both the storms as well as the rainfall. What goes up must come down with evaporation. So it's no surprise. What is surprising is just how good we are at fooling ourselves and pretending that, you know, this is some major shocking storm that has nothing to do with the climate crisis. You know, my hope is that this will be, if Katrina wasn't the wake-up call, hopefully Sandy or Frankenstorm is the wake-up call that this country and our political leaders desperately need in order to get us on the path towards the kind of energy revolution that we absolutely need to take to protect our future and the future of our grandchildren.
Well, you know, during the Republican National Convention, presidential candidate Mitt Romney laughed at efforts to stop rising seas, and now this storm surge from Hurricane Sandy is threatening the North American coast, the East Coast, as never before. Bill McKibben of 350.org suggested Romney might want to rethink that. What has storm surge got to do with rising seas?
Well, of course, as you know, we've got the sea level rising due to climate change. We know that that is happening. That's part of the background. And then when you have more and more intense storms, of course, that results in higher waves. And of course, we've got a full moon at the same time, so we're having an even higher tide. And all of that adds up for a region of the country like New York City, which is already so close to the edge of high tide at good times, to a disaster potentially unfolding. And we're hearing that Atlantic City is underwater. Other parts of the New Jersey shore are facing massive deluges potentially. And this is, of course, exactly what the scientists have predicted. What people like NASA's top climate scientist James Hansen have said is actually we didn't anticipate that it would be this bad this soon. It's happening a lot faster than many of the top scientists expected. And as the Arctic melts, of course, that increases the intensity of these storms, because where once it was sort of a buffer for the ups and downs and the temperatures and so on, and it's now with the Arctic receding, there's more heat being held in the polar region. Of course, that heat has to escape one way or another, and that energy is churning up more and more storms.
And, you know, a lot of folks don't know this, but the extra heat that's trapped by these rising greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is going straight into the ocean. And that seems to be an important part of this story, even with Hurricane Sandy.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, I'm wondering if this will, we finally had President Obama mentioning climate change in response to an interview he did, I think, with MTV recently, but it's really too bad that this didn't come up at all in the debates, and that the politicians in general seem to be backpedaling as fast as possible away from any discussion of the issues around climate change at a time when we desperately need to have this conversation. So as you know, I'm just back from Germany and Denmark, and the conversations in those countries couldn't be more different and more hopeful in the sense they are really taking very seriously the need to move off of fossil fuels as well as away from nuclear power in the aftermath of Fukushima. And maybe this will be what it takes to finally have the conversation on climate change if New York City goes underwater. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, there have been scientists and frustrated green activists thinking only a major disaster will force this change in thinking in America. And I am looking forward to hearing more from you about what's happening in Germany and Denmark. I know it's just like a different world over there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, too, when we get these huge rainfall events, they can happen even without a hurricane. They've been popping up all over the world. In New England, the biggest impact of that tropical storm Irene was the relentless rain, the flooding out of roads and homes, whole communities. Can you talk about extreme rainfall events and global warming?
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things we keep hearing about in all different parts of the world is record rainfall. Pakistan, a vast majority of Pakistan was underwater for 2 years in a row. We hear about flooding in the Philippines, in other parts of Asia, China, and of course in this country, in the United States, we've had record flooding. And, you know, again, it has a lot to do with the extra heat in the atmosphere and how that results in an increase in evaporation of water. And, of course, it must come down. And so it's coming down in some places in record levels, and it's not coming down in other areas in parts of the country where we've seen record drought. And, unfortunately, there's sort of a vicious cycle. Once a part of the country gets very, very dry, as in the Southwest, it's predicted that it'll be even drier and that those desert areas will expand. So it's almost as if climate change is sort of putting different climate cycles on steroids. And what was once a relatively moist area, a rainy part of the country may all of a sudden become just one deluge after another. And the drier regions will become even more dry. You know, I think we've got a very short window of time, as you know, to turn this around. It's possible we may have already passed certain tipping points, but time is of the essence. We are making some changes. I mean, I don't want to say it's all gloom and doom. We have somehow, if the numbers are to be believed, we've actually reduced our emissions in the United States. I'm somewhat skeptical of those numbers because I don't think they're counting the emissions from fracking that's going on at a record pace. I think they haven't calculated the fugitive emissions from all the fracking that's going on. However, if the numbers are to be believed, due to both the economic downturn and to people driving more efficient cars and so on, it seems that at least we're not headed in, you know, as bad a direction as we could have a few years ago. So there are signs of some changes going on, and we just have to build on that and build on the momentum. Of course, the tar sands in Canada are going to be our biggest challenge, both for this country and for Canada. And hopefully that won't be a foregone conclusion that the pipeline will be built regardless of who gets elected. I'm afraid that we have both Obama and Romney suggesting that they're going to move forward with that pipeline, which would be very, very challenging for those of us who care about climate change.
And for all the money they think they're going to make out of that terrible oil that they produce, we're going to lose a lot more. We just had Munich Re, the insurance company that kind of insures other insurance companies. And they're saying that there's going to be, you know, North America is being very hard hit by these extreme climate events. They expect to see more. So we're going to lose billions. I see a point at which cities will struggle to recover from whether it's storms or droughts, just time after time. Maybe some places won't be able to come back from these things.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, we're already talking tens of billions of dollars just from this one storm. And that, I think, is just the wind damage. We're not talking about water damage. Tens of billions of dollars just from one storm. And you imagine, what could we do with tens of billions of dollars of investment in clean energy? We could certainly do an awful lot more in terms of getting towards energy independence, which both candidates say that they claim to hold dear. So I don't know. I mean, will we act rationally after this storm? It remains to be seen. We probably will continue our short-term thinking, but if enough of us keep pushing and speaking out on and connecting the dots between this record storm and the record greenhouse gas emissions in the Earth's atmosphere, maybe we'll start to see some changes.
Well, I'm hoping you're hunkered down in a safe place. Maybe the power will go out. Are you ready for 2-3 days without electricity?
Yeah, I've got food all stored up in the cooler and plenty of candles and batteries and emergency rooms, and I think we'll be fine. I'm more worried about people that are literally losing their lives in places like Haiti as a result of our energy profligacy, but I guess it's going to take a while for us to wake up to this.
We are talking with Green Radio reporter Daphne Wisham, the longtime host of Earthbeat and now a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She is in Washington, D.C., just as the storm lands. This is recorded on October 29th. Daphne, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for all that you do, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can find links to Daphne Wisham's article at Fire Dog Lake and lots more on the link between climate change and hurricanes like Sandy in my show blog at ecoshock.info, ecoshock.info. You might think humans would learn from disasters like this. Apparently not yet. Australia suffered a terrible drought for years, ending farming in parts of the country. The Black Saturday bushfires of 2009 killed 173 people. They were horrific. Then torrential rains flooded out coastal cities and towns. No matter, mate. Australia is steaming full ahead to expand their coal exports into a world climate wrecking status equal to Canada's infamous tar sands. Here is what you haven't heard. Between Canada's tar sands and Australia's massive coal exports, we make two of the nicest climate wreckers around. Both countries are ramping up dirty carbon production to feed their economies. Let's tune in to what is happening down under with Georgina Woods, senior climate and energy campaigner for Greenpeace Australia Pacific. Georgina, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Well, before we talk about the huge expansion, how big are Australia's coal exports now?
It fluctuates year to year, but at current levels, Australia is exporting around 300 million tonnes per annum of coal. Some of that is coking coal for making steel, and some of it's thermal coal for electricity.
And where does that put you in the ranking of world coal exporters?
Our total coal exports are the biggest export volume in the world. We are second to Indonesia in the thermal coal ranks, but we're certainly right up there and have a big influence on the Asian coal market.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Who is buying Australian coal?
Well, traditionally it's been predominantly Japan and South Korea and Taiwan that buy coal from Australia. Japan's a big coal burner and doesn't have coal of its own, so it's been a big customer country of Australia's for many years. More and more in recent years and in the future, we're going to be selling a lot of the coal that we mine to China and India, who are both expanding their coal-fired generation capacity at the moment.
Well, let's talk about the 9 mega coal mines now being proposed in Australia. Please, Georgina, take as long as you want to tell us about those.
Well, the report that Greenpeace Australia Pacific released recently focused in on one region where coal mining is expanding. It's important to understand that the Galilee Basin, which is the region we were talking about in our report, isn't the only place where coal exports are expanding in Australia. There are dozens of new coal mines proposed in various parts of the states of New South Wales and Queensland. But the Galilee Basin is special because it's a region entirely new to coal mining. It's a long way from the coast, and the coal mines that are being proposed for that region are exceptionally large. So currently, the largest coal mine in Australia produces around 30 million tonnes of coal every year. And two of the mines currently proposed for the Galilee Basin will produce 60 million tonnes of coal every year. So it is going to be coal mining on a scale that is unprecedented in Australia. At the moment, there are 9 coal mines proposed for that region that have production capacity defined. And so we know that the intentions of the coal industry to pull around 330 million tonnes of coal from that region every year at full production.
That is amazing. So where do the Aboriginal people of Australia stand on this massive expansion of coal mining?
Well, there are different communities of Aboriginal people around the country with different languages and different, you know, organisations. In Queensland, there is native title law that requires Aboriginal people to negotiate, to provide agreement to enterprises like this. One of the coal mines in the Galilee Basin, the company has already negotiated agreements with Aboriginal communities for that mine, but the others are going to need to do that. And it's possible that there will be cultural heritage impacts of these coal mines and of the rail lines that will go to the coast because they are so large. And it's an area that's been, until now, given over to grazing cattle, which isn't a high disturbance occupation.
Okay. Well, I'd like to switch over a little bit to the role of the media in Australia about this. Could you tell the world about Australia's sweetheart, Gina Rinehart?
Yes. Gina Rinehart is the chairman of a company called Hancock Prospecting. And she comes from a mining family in Western Australia. Her father was an iron prospector, and her company has a great interest in iron mining, which is really big in Western Australia. Her company basically developed several of the projects in the Galilee Basin, two of the mines and one of the coal ports that's being proposed to export this coal, and then sold a large chunk of the ownership of those projects to an Indian company called GVK. So Rinehart's company still does own an interest in it, and she is a very vocal advocate for mining interests in Australia and sort of takes up political causes in the interest of mining and free trade and, the ability of mining companies to import labour, and sort of generally kind of runs an agenda of freeing up interests for mining to be able to mine where they like and operate in the way that they choose.
And I understand Ms. Rinehart is a huge fan of climate deniers like Andrew Bolt. She wants to give them top billing in the newspapers and television stations she buys. Is that right?
Rinehart has been connected to climate-denying people. Certainly she, in the press, has been associated with a move. She bought part of one of the television channels here and installed Andrew Bolt in a program there. That was certainly the way it was reported. And it's also reported that she's interested in buying, and she has bought a large stake in one of our big newspaper companies here as well. Yes, there are, there is sort of quite a intense climate denial movement in Australia, and we get a lot of sort of visiting climate deniers from the United States and the United Kingdom, brought out by various business interests in Australia to try and sow seeds of confusion in the community about global warming.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Sydney, Australia. We are talking with Greenpeace senior climate and energy campaigner Georgina Woods. Georgina, here is what shocks me about the rapid expansion of the coal and of climate denial in Australia. It seems like such an insult to all those who lost their lives in the horrible fires, the big floods, and those agricultural droughts. The farmers, some of them committed suicide. They were so severe, and it happened time and time again in recent years. How can anyone doubt the climate is changing after all that?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, I suppose, because climate change is such a big problem and has so many complex manifestations that it's hard for people to, be really clear about it. And it's easy for people to sow confusion if they choose to. I think that's also, it's a symptom of people being frightened by a problem that is much larger than any we've faced before and much more complex. And so it's natural for people to cling on to ideas that it's not a problem, that it's not happening. And those are the kinds of vulnerabilities that are exploited by fossil fuel companies and climate deniers who don't want our community to act to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels.
And then we have the simple fact that the Great Barrier Reef, a treasure to Australia and to the world, is bleaching and dying, mainly due to global warming. Are Australians ready to let these great coral reefs die to provide more short-term jobs in the coal mining industry?
Well, the Great Barrier Reef is really at the centre of the coal debate in the state of Queensland in Australia. Because it is so obviously threatened by climate change, and recently a paper was released that showed that even 2 degrees of global warming, which is a commitment that our government has made with governments around the world, is probably going to be devastating for coral reefs and the Great Barrier Reef more particularly. So it's, right up there as being under threat from climate change. But it's also right immediately now under threat from the coal industry, because there are up to 9 new coal export terminals being proposed to be built for the Great Barrier Reef coast by various coal corporations. So it's the icon of the coal campaign in Queensland, because it's threatened by coastal development. And just last week, 2 weeks ago, our federal environment minister gave approval for a 60 million tonne coal export terminal to be built in the Great Barrier Reef World Heritage Area to export coal from the mine that's partly owned by Reinhardt's company. So in Australia, yes, the people have a great emotional attachment to the reef and take very seriously their responsibility to protect the reef. But right now we're seeing utter failure of governments and certainly corporations to put the interests of the Great Barrier Reef ahead of their short-term financial and political interests.
So, Georgina Woods, how did you become part of the climate movement?
Well, I live in a city called Newcastle in New South Wales in Australia, which is the biggest coal exporting port in the world. We export now over 100 million tonnes from Newcastle to the Asian coal markets every year. And I've always been a conservationist. I was involved in forest protection and marine protection. And living in this city, which is a beautiful city, but which is emotionally and economically tied to the coal industry and was part of expanding coal from Australia and therefore climate change, made me realise that I needed to be part of ensuring that Australia wasn't driving global warming and, eventually killing forests and ecosystems and people around the world. So I guess I was intimately acquainted with the coal industry, having grown up in a region that has traditionally been one of the bigger mining regions in the country.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. And what is being done to resist these mega coal mines now being proposed in Australia?
Well, there are lots of people who are starting to draw the line against coal and say, we've really had enough of this and we can't keep on expanding this industry any further. in different regions, that's happening in different ways. In the region where I live, in the Hunter Valley, there are people taking coal mines to court who are blockading exploration drilling to prevent coal mining from going ahead. And there's sort of ongoing direct action and civil disobedience to chip away at the monolithic power of the coal industry in our region. In other parts of the country, the farming communities particularly are very concerned about the rollout of coal mining in regions that haven't traditionally been affected by it and the impact that will have on land and water, and are locking the gate. They've joined a movement called the Lock the Gate Alliance, who are drawing a line and saying, no, we're not going to have extractive industries on fertile farmland in Australia. So there is a growing resistance movement, partly based in farming communities and partly coming from the conservation movement. It does need to get a lot bigger if we're going to really stop the industry from expanding to the degree that it's currently proposing to. But Greenpeace is really hoping to help that movement grow bigger and to protect the Great Barrier Reef from the coal terminals that are being proposed to be built along its coast.
Can our listeners in other parts of the world help in some way?
I think so. I mean, we are trying to connect up with communities around the world that are fighting fossil fuel development. We're in contact a lot with people in the United States who are fighting coal exports becoming a bigger industry there. And we would love to connect up with people in Canada who are fighting tar sands and the XL pipeline that's going down to the States, because it's our view that governments and corporations have basically abrogated their responsibility to stand up for the things that we value, the communities and also the ecosystems that are under threat from climate change and fossil fuel development. And so it's really up to the people to wrest back that responsibility and say, we don't want these beautiful places to be ruined by the fossil fuel industry, and we're going to work together to make it stop.
Where can people go to get reliable information about the protests and the business of exporting fossil fuels from your country? Can you suggest websites, a Facebook page or Twitter feeds?
Well, there's quite a few at the moment. There isn't one single location. Certainly for the Queensland coal expansion and the coal terminals that are being proposed for the Great Barrier Reef, people can visit www.savethereef.org.au, which is Greenpeace's campaign website for the work that we're doing in Queensland. I would also suggest that people Google the Lock the Gate Alliance and visit their site, because they draw together all of the protest actions that are happening in farming communities and regions in New South Wales and Queensland, and they can find out a lot about their activities there too.
And is there anything else you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
Well, I do think that the time that we have to prevent dangerous climate change from, you know, slipping outside of the control of the human community is rapidly slipping away from us. And so it is important for those of us who care about beautiful places and about communities around the world to intensify our efforts to stop fossil fuel developments from going ahead. We don't really have the option anymore of pleading with government to do it for us. It's in our hands, and we need to do it ourselves.
Thank you. This is Radio EcoShock, and you've been listening to the senior climate and energy campaigner for Australia and the Pacific, Georgina Woods. And thanks so much, Georgina, and please keep us posted about these new climate-killing mines.
I would love to. Thanks for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith.
All the people seeking truth and change worldwide, coming up slowly, and many more seem to be opening their eyes. Coming up slowly, centuries of twisted truth and lies. Coming up slowly, many people, many places, sick and tired. Coming up slowly, hey, mister, you see I've seen this before, and I don't believe you. This time, you see I'm opening my eyes. You keep in secret. Each day.
We started out this program with sirens wailing as nature is wheeled into the emergency room. We'll go back to Canada, to Ontario, where nuclear madness is in full bloom. It's only a matter of time until the Great Lakes are irradiated, with millions of people downstream and downwind. And the radioactive trucks are already rolling down the public highways all over North America. It's the dirty secret of the industry. They're calling it Yucca Mountain North, except it's even worse than that. Canada's most populous province of Ontario has a dangerous plan to bury radioactive waste from three giant nuclear power plants. They want to toss it in limestone caverns right beside one of the Great Lakes. We've reached Brenane Lloyd of the nonprofit group Northwatch to find out more. Brenane, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Why don't we start by telling our world audience what the Great Lakes are and who is downstream if radiation leaks out of this proposed dump site?
The Great Lakes is the largest set of in-water lakes in the world. So it's home to most of the population of Ontario, although I live in northern Ontario in a less populated area. And Lake Huron is the second in the chain of lakes. So further downstream, we have Lake Erie and Lake Ontario, which are the most densely populated areas.
Right, and there's a lot of American states along there. We got
Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, Michigan are all downstream.
Right, so that's a lot of people. We're talking Cleveland, Buffalo, and just everybody is down there. And if it leaks, those are the people who are going to have to deal with it too.
Well, and I think with both this proposal and a proposal to bury high-level nuclear waste, it's not a question of if it leaks, it's a question of when it leaks. Not even the nuclear industry says that these systems will keep the waste in forever. They say they'll keep the waste contained for a long period of time. Of course, when you're dealing with nuclear waste, it's radioactive and so hazardous for a very, 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 very long time, virtually into eternity. So keeping it contained, if all goes well, for a long time isn't good enough.
What is the agency trying to build the site, and what do they want to put in there?
Ontario Power Generation is the proponent for the burial scheme at the Bruce Nuclear Power Generating Station, which is right on the shore of Lake Huron. And the waste they're proposing to bury there are low and intermediate level waste. So it's operating waste and refurbishment waste from Ontario's reactors. So Ontario has 20 reactors, and all of the low and intermediate level waste from those reactors are shipped to something called the Western Waste Management Facility, which basically is just a long name for a storage site they've set up at the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station. So we already have a problem because we have 20 reactors generating low and intermediate level waste. And as they are rebuilt, and some have already been rebuilt, there's plans to rebuild more, they also generate something called refurbishment waste. The low-level waste has a lower level of radioactivity. The intermediate-level waste can be highly radioactive. There's a range of waste in that category, but in Canada, wastes are categorized as low, intermediate, or high, and they only get to be called high if they're the reactor fuel waste. So if there are other kinds of highly radioactive waste, you know, resins that have been used, filters that have been used to collect stray radionuclides in the cooling pool at the reactor station for 20 years, highly radioactive, they're called intermediate because they're not fuel waste. So Ontario Power Generation is the proponent for this scheme for the burial of low and so-called intermediate level waste. Ontario Power Generation is also the majority shareholder in a company called the Nuclear Waste Management Organization, which also has a scheme to bury the high-level waste, the nuclear fuel waste, and they're still looking for a site for that. But these two different burial schemes are intertwined. Same companies, in the case of some of the intermediate-level waste, similar levels of radioactivity, and really we think that one of the motivations for the low and intermediate level waste burial at Bruce is to make it a poster child for the burial of nuclear waste in Canada. And the industry has other ideas. They have ideas about burying it next to Chalk River, and they're looking for a site to bury the high-level waste. You know, it's a huge problem in itself. It's also problematic because it is, by our assessment, intended to be a precedent and set a precedent and pave the way for other burial schemes for other highly radioactive waste in Canada.
So who owns Ontario Power Generation? Is it a government agency? Is it a private company?
Ontario Power Generation is nominally a Crown corporation, so it's owned by the people of Ontario. It's operated by a board, which is described as being arm's length from the government of Ontario, although it can be directed by the government of Ontario. It's certainly arm's length, long arm's length from the people of Ontario.
I was just amazed at how weak this deep geological repository sounds to me. I mean, I'm picturing granite 2 miles down or maybe even salt deposits miles down, but it's not like that at all. Can you tell us about this repository?
The caverns will be about 500 meters, I think 680 is their current number, but these are all, you know, estimates, but about half a kilometer down, and there will be shafts go down, tunnels go out, and caverns or rooms, picture them as caves carved off those tunnels. And it's in limestone. So the top levels of rock are shale, and the lower down levels of rock where the repository will actually be situated are limestone. And Ontario Power Generation, by their design, has very minimal emphasis or very minimal design for engineered containers. So the industry, in industry speak, they talk in burial schemes, they talk about it being a multiple barrier approach, which means you have multiple layers. And typically they talk about having an engineered barrier and then a rock barrier. Now, of course, in the longer term, the difficulty is even if by their design, both those barriers will eventually fail. What's interesting and, you know, troubling with the Bruce design, the OPG's burial at the Bruce, is that there's minimal emphasis on the engineered barrier. It's basically going to go down in the packaging that it shipped in. And then the multiple rock barriers are supposed to be limestone and then shale. Well, you know, unless those radionuclides are trained to go straight up, they're not going to have two barriers. They're going to have one barrier, and that's the limestone. And I think for most people, we have a sense of limestone. It's something that's easily cut to build buildings and so on, makes beautiful white stone buildings, and not much of a barrier. And it's really the cornerstone of their design.
And you mentioned the shipping containers. How will nuclear waste get to this site?
Well, the waste is already being shipped to this site. We already have large volumes of waste being shipped from the Darlington and Pickering nuclear reactor stations to the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station and stored there. There is very little known about the effects of that shipping. We've just gone through or in the middle of a review right now for the license renewal for the Darlington reactor. And one of the things that we were looking at was the shipment of these wastes. And Ontario Power Generation was not required to provide any information about the dose, the radioactivity that people along the route are exposed to. Now, there's two ways of looking at radioactive exposure along transportation route. One is what's called normal exposure. So if there's no accident, and then upset conditions, that's when there is an accident. Ontario Power Generation wasn't required to provide information about either of those. We know from other situations that there is a level of exposure, and we know that there is no safe level of exposure to radioactivity. So if there is a level of exposure, there is a level of risk, and that level of risk increases correspondingly with the amount of exposure. And Ontario Power Generation has not been required to provide information about that exposure and so about that risk. And in fact, for the review for the burial scheme, the transportation issues are excluded from the review with the rationale that it's already happening. And for the Darlington new build, proposal to build new reactors at Darlington, excluded because it's already happening. For the proposal to rebuild reactors at Darlington, so extend their operation for 20 years, transportation excluded because it's already happening. But it's already happening with no public input and no public disclosure about the radioactivity, about the levels of exposure, about the dose associated with being along the transportation route as these materials are moved through communities.
Well, you know, I think this is one of the dirty little secrets of that whole nuclear industry throughout North America and the world. But, you know, especially in the United States and Canada, there are big trucks running down our major public highways through cities with radioactive materials, and we don't know about it, and we don't know the risks, and we don't know that radiation escapes from them even when they're just driving down the road. Have I got that right?
You've got that right. And what we have increasingly in our cities and even in our small cities, we increasingly have gridlock, we have transportation stops, we have freeways that turn into parking lots. And if you're sitting beside one of those trucks for 2 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, your dose increases correspondingly. So the longer you are in proximity to that shipment, the greater your dose. Now, the industry will say these are small exposures, these are small doses, and that could be, although that's not really been disclosed in the case of the Ontario shipments, there is still an increase of risk, and it's well established in the science that there is no level of exposure that does not have risk attached to it.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I lived in Ontario for years. We were always nervous one of these plants was going to go. The CANDU reactors were designed in the 1960s and haven't changed since. The giant Pickering reactor sits right next to millions of people living in Toronto and across the lake from Buffalo. It's been plagued with problems and shutdowns, and that Darlington reactor complex was upwind from my country retreat. You couldn't get away from nuclear worry, and I had to move away from all that. So our guest is Brenane Lloyd of Northwatch, and I want to ask you, after Fukushima, Germany has sworn to get off nuclear power. Aren't people in Ontario worried about another Fukushima-type meltdown ruining their province?
Well, I think people in Ontario are. I think the government of Ontario has stalled in, you know, they're stuck in some, I don't know if it's 1970s think or 1960s think. In 2008, they actually put out a request for proposals from nuclear vendors to build up to four new reactors. Now, they haven't got a proposal that they can, you know, that they can live with because the costs were way over what they expected. Dalton McGuinty, the premier, called it sticker shock. And the vendors, the nuclear industry, was not prepared to take on cost overruns. Now, Ontario has just signed a deal with two potential vendors and given them $26 million just to work out a price for possibly selling them new reactors. They still haven't committed to them, and they certainly shouldn't commit to them. So there's some ideological mud that the provincial government seems to be stuck in. And so I think the people are certainly ready to leave nuclear behind, although unfortunately because of the wastes that have been generated, we'll never actually leave it behind. We'll have to be, you know, in a guardian position forever because of the wastes that have been created. And we certainly have the alternatives. There's lots of enthusiasm for the alternatives. There is a renewable energy contract option which has been the, or supply exceeds opportunity. There are more on renewable energy projects in the proposal, in the queue, then the Ontario Power Authority can integrate into the grid. And that's largely because we have these nuclear units which occupy so much of the grid and create real roadblocks, literal barriers to renewable energies coming online. So the people are ready to move, and the power, renewable power, is ready to move, but we have the provincial government, which seems to be just stuck on the old thing of nuclear. And we've got a large nuclear lobby in Ontario, and perhaps that answers it, or perhaps they just haven't been reading the tea leaves.
Well, or reading the newspapers about what's going on in Fukushima. I mean, it's just a mess there, and it's going to be for hundreds of years. They don't know what to do with this type of accident, and you could have a multiple meltdown in Ontario as well. Now, Brenane, we started talking about the proposed Yucca North nuclear waste repository, a plan right near Lake Huron. There are plenty of Americans living down lake from this Canadian nuke dumping spot. Everybody in northern Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York State needs to pay attention. Have you heard from American groups who object to this plan?
Yes, there's a large number of American residents are expressing their concern, and they're expressing their concern to a hearing panel. There's a joint federal review panel has been set up to review this proposal, and there's an opportunity to send comments in and make your views known. There will be a hearing held sometime in 2013, we expect. And we're hearing for a lot of Americans. There's American organizations, but also individual residents who are very concerned about the proposal and its potential impact on the lake. People are also concerned about the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station itself. And, you know, it's a very large operation, multiple reactors, multiple waste sites, an old reactor, Douglas Point, sitting right on the edge of the lake, has been shut down for decades but never decommissioned. And there's also an incinerator there. They incinerate a lot of the low-level radioactive waste that comes from the three nuclear reactor stations in Ontario. So folks on the U.S. side have many concerns and many legitimate concerns about the reactor station, and the proposal to bury the waste underneath the station on the shore of Lake Huron is certainly one large addition to that list of concerns.
You've just described a really frightening mess to me. Okay, so now, do you think the government will be able to ram through this deep geological disposal facility on Lake Huron, or could a public outcry still stop it?
Well, I think that a public outcry can still stop it. I think we have to use all avenues available. I think that people should, you know, put their oar in the public review, but also express themselves to provincial decision makers in Ontario, but also to the elected folks on the U.S. side. They have great influence on the provincial government in Ontario. So I think that a hue and cry is completely called for, and I think that it can be effective. There was, you might recall, your listeners may recall, there was a plan by Bruce Power a few years ago to ship radioactive steam generators through the Great Lakes to Sweden for something they were calling recycling. It was actually releasing of radioactive materials into the free market, but there was an incredible response to that, and it was stopped. And license was issued for the transport, license expired. So I think that there's no time better than today to become engaged around these issues. And certainly that basket of issues at the Bruce Nuclear Generating Station is a very good focus.
Please give us your website and any other places we should look to find out more.
Good site to look for information about this burial scheme is it's www.bruce-nuclear-waste-burial.ca.
Okay, I'll put a link to that in my blog at ecoshock.info, and also to your group and to some other groups that are working on this, especially on the state side. We've been talking with Bernane Lloyd of Northwatch, located in North Bay, Ontario. Thank you, Bernane.
Thank you so much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Many people on a mission to unite. We're coming up slowly. Many people spreading message far and wide. We're coming up slowly. And every message has a universal tie. Coming up slowly. Every message for the fate of the unborn child. Coming up slowly. You see, I've seen this before, and I don't believe it. This time, you see, I'm confident. We keep it secret.
So Hurricane Sandy is just a metaphor for our current condition to the state we are in. Right now, we are the storm. Someday when the black clouds clear, maybe we'll all be the rainbow instead. Don't despair. We need you, each and every one. One mind awake can become stronger than 1,000 zombies sleepwalking in a dying civilization. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you, really, for caring about your world.
When the grid goes down.
it goes down.